Good morning, everybody, and thanks for attending our session. I'm going to put my hat on as a local public health practitioner and say, the goal of this is to say, what can you take home from this report that you might actually be able to use when you go back and assess the status of obesity prevention efforts in your community or evaluate their impact? So I will, that's the goal, and hopefully we'll meet this goal through this presentation. So what I'm going to talk about here are two dimensions of evaluating progress at the local level. The first is more focused on assessment and surveillance. So how do we know how we're doing at the community level, where the gaps are, where we should focus our resources? The second is how do we evaluate the effectiveness of the interventions happening at the community level? Are they really moving the dial on obesity prevention or its upstream determinants? The key challenge facing us at the local level is that we have limited resources and we have limited data, as many of the other my colleagues have already mentioned. So how can we be creative and flexible with what we've got to address this, and what kind of new evaluation methodologies might be useful to apply at the local level to overcome these limitations? So first I'll start with the assessment and surveillance component of this work, and then I'll move on later to the evaluation of the intervention aspects of it. With the community evaluation plan has six general steps which one can follow to do an assessment or track over time what's happening with obesity prevention and obesity at the community level. And they're listed here, and these are relatively standard approaches to doing a community health assessment. The report goes into detail on each of these six categories, and I won't pick on all of them here now, but I will go into give some representative examples of what you might find in the report, and hopefully that will pique your curiosity to explore more deeply. As mentioned before, one of the big challenges we have is that routinely collected data are not highly available at the local level compared to state and national levels. So we have a paucity of actual data sources from which to draw on to construct our indicators and do our measurement. So if you look at the 37 national data sources that were identified by the committee, only three of them exist for communities of all sizes across the nation. That's the American Community Survey done by the Census, the Quarterly Food at Home database, and the Census County Zip and Business Patterns. An additional seven data sets are available for some larger communities, and Jamie mentioned some of those, for example, for the Micropolitan Metropolitan Burfus Survey, or some larger school districts, for example, with YRBSS. The National Compensation Survey and National Immunization Survey actually have some breastfeeding information embedded in them. The AC Nielsen's scan data can be looked at for some larger regions. School Health Policies and Practice Database System and the RUD Legislative Dataset also have information at some of the larger areas. And finally, this makes us be creative then, looking for more data sources that could be available in your community that might be unique and special assets of your community. And some of you might have local surveys, your schools might collect and report on BMI data, WIC data might be available for analysis, and so on. And we have a table, Table 7.4, in the report that lists some examples of communities that have these, and you might see if your communities have these or think about developing them. Here's an example from King County, where I work, where we do a survey every few years called Communities Count to get at social and health indicators not routinely captured by some of the national data sets. And then these are then reported on, and for example, some of them are quite related to obesity prevention. This one is a question that asked about satisfaction with access, for example, to public transit. And a number of communities around the country do local surveying. Then, based on what data sources are available locally, we went through the process, as Jamie described, to say what kind of indicators can be constructed from these data sources that are available at the local level. If you go to Table 7.2 in the report, that actually provides a list of indicators that you might find available at all communities or in some of the larger communities. Available for all communities are adult obesity and overweight, in the physical activity arena, active transportation by walking and biking, density of recreational facilities, and leisure time physical activity. For nutrition, adult fruit and vegetable consumption, the food outlet densities of various types of food outlets, farmers market density, the presence of food deserts, and the density of stores that accept SNAP and WIC. That's not a very big set of indicators, actually, and that points out the problem in bringing this work down to the community level. Some of the larger communities have additional data on youth obesity and overweight rates, on youth physical activity levels, screen time among youth, and youth school physical activity participation in and out of PE. And they also have some information on sugar-sweetened beverage consumption and fruit and vegetable consumption. Still a fairly limited set. Here's what Table 7.2 looks like, and it shows for each indicator topic, this happens to be ones around food and beverage environment, what data source is available. If green, if it's available for large communities, which tend to be larger metropolitan areas, small, which tends to be smaller communities, 50,000 or less population, yellow if it's available for selected larger or smaller communities, and red if it's not available at all, the best we could ascertain. Unfortunately, when you look for this table, there's a lot of red, particularly for the smaller communities. If you, though, for communities wanting to do this kind of work, there are some very sophisticated and very useful web-based resources you can go to create community-specific, city-specific, county-specific reports of the available data. So one was already mentioned, called the Community Commons, and its sister site, communityhealthneedsassessment.org. This actually has 7,000 plus now layers of data that can be used in a GIS system to produce reports at various geographic levels, depending on the density of the data available for that reporting. County Health Rankings is another very useful website to report information at the county level. The USDA Food Atlas, the CDC Diabetes Interactive Atlas, has information about physical activity, nutrition. The Census, American Community Survey, and the county's zip business patterns probably go down to the smallest resolution geographically. And then the Health and Human Services Community Health Status Indicators Report also goes down to the county level, but hasn't been updated since 2006. So, for example, if you went to the chna.org website, you could produce, in this case I did this for my county, a report on adult obesity, comparing how your county is relative to the state and the nation. It has a little dashboard monitor to show if you're a particular county, where it stands relative to those two benchmarks, and a map which you can scale in and out, showing how your county rate compares to that of adjacent counties. Community Commons also can produce maps. This is an example of the Atlanta area, which shows the counties around Atlanta and what the overweight rate is among adults. And you can produce these maps relatively quickly and simply for your communities. The other sites, for example, Community Commons, County Health Rankings also allows you to do some of this kind of work. But given the paucity of data at the local level, there's a need for looking at emerging and innovative data sources. And the report goes through a number of these. I just pulled out a few examples here. One is the process that communities are going through, as we found out, by systematically mapping the assets and the interventions happening in their communities. These could be policy changes, they could be systems changes, they could be environment changes, they could be programs in their communities, and looking at how those change over time. There are data systems that can be used to systematically catalog and input this kind of data, and then have reporting functions. One developed by Steve Fawcett and his colleagues was at the University of Kansas is the online data documentation and support system. And we are using that, for example, in our city to evaluate our community transformation grant at this point. Collaboration with other sectors who collect data might turn up some interesting information. So, for example, the State Health Department of Oregon and their Department of Motor Vehicle Licensing are working together to use, as you can see in the Oregon license, and many states do this as well, you report your height and weight at the time of applying for a license, and they're using this actually as a metric of adult obesity data that can go down to the small area level. Crowdsourcing is another emerging option. We already heard about the measured self stuff that Deanna mentioned, but there's also some interesting applications, more developed perhaps in communicable diseases such as HealthMap, where people report either symptoms or diagnoses of communicable diseases, and that's actually been used to monitor flu epidemics and outbreaks or other kind of communicable disease outbreaks, and that technology could be applied as people report other aspects around physical activity, for example, or what they're eating. Here's an example of how both web-based monitoring and crowdsourcing has been used to look at the impact of putting in bike lanes in a city. And so the image on the left is pre-bike lane, or your left, and on my right is post-bike lane. And there was the same webcam that was monitoring this intersection, and it captured how many bicyclists were there. And what they did is they crowdsourced these images out on the web to let people count frame by frame how many bicyclists they saw, and then looked at inter-rater reliability and came up with an estimate of pre- and post-utilization of bicycling. There also are analytic methods that can be used when local data are not available. The most commonly used one is probably synthetic estimation, in which you adjust a national estimate, a state estimate, or a county estimate to your demographic features of the community you're interested in, and do some direct adjustment to try to approximate what the rate would be at that level. A little bit more sophisticated or Bayesian estimation models, which take sparse data in a small area and then enhance the robustness of that data by, in effect, borrowing data or strength from surrounding or contiguous communities to provide a better posterior estimate of what the rate of interest is. And then qualitative methods actually can shed a lot of information on what is happening in a community, even though it doesn't have the same valence, perhaps, in some circles as quantitative information. It's actually quite useful. And we go into a little bit of detail and provide resources for how to use these methodologies. Assessing inequities is a key theme, as has already been mentioned, and being able to describe at the community level differential exposures, vulnerabilities, and health outcomes is critical to reducing health disparities and inequities and moving forward for health for all. So we recommend analyzing by race, ethnicity, by socioeconomic status markers, by neighborhood and gender, and you can, for example, see there are clear gradients at the local level, in this case, in obesity by household income, which point out to the needs of where you might most target your interventions. Okay, so shift gears. And now we'll move to the evaluation of interventions at the community level. So across the country, many, many communities are mounting interventions to try to reduce obesity rates, increase physical activity, increase healthy eating. But there's real challenges in evaluating these given limited resources. So we laid out a general process, which is then described in more detail for each of these six components. In doing an evaluation, many of these would be familiar to evaluators already. And what I'd like to do is, again, dive down a little bit more deeply just to give you a flavor for what's in the report about some of these stages in doing an evaluation of a community-level initiative. One thing the committee identified as critical is to know who your stakeholders are before you launch the evaluation. Who do you want the evaluation data to influence? Who do you want to have read it? How do you want the data and the evaluation findings to be used? And then engage those stakeholders right from the beginning. If you do that, they will have increased confidence in the quality and the product that you produce, and they'll use the results. It might allow you to gain wider access to, like, school-based data, for example, or childcare program data that you can then incorporate into your evaluation if you include those stakeholders in the beginning. It generates a more comprehensive set of questions and outcomes that might be irrelevant to the stakeholder organization that an evaluator herself might not think of. And it's important to point out, though, that this level of stakeholder engagement, there's a spectrum. There's not one size fits all. Depending on your community and your purposes, you might dive deep and actually include community partners as co-investigators or co-evaluators. Or you might have them play more of a review and advisory role of helping define the original questions and reviewing the results once you have them. Another key theme is cultural competence, and we wanted to make sure that cultural competence is addressed both in how the evaluation happens and how understanding how cultural context actually shapes outcomes in different communities. Now I'm going to go through and finish up here with a few specifics of evaluation methodologies that the committee thinks is useful and valuable. The first is the general use of logic models, which many evaluators already use as their standard tricks to evaluate initiatives. So we have produced a generic logic model that could be used by communities and then tweaked to customize to evaluation of their specific interventions. Some of the implications, though, that we wanted to draw out in the use of logic models is that it makes sense to look to the short-term and outputs and to the activities as valid and important targets for evaluation, because many of the intermediate things, such as behavior change or obesity rates, are too far in the future for most evaluation efforts to be able to capture given time frames and funding limitations. It's also important to look to the left-hand side of the logic model to collect the data that's going to be useful for formative feedback so programs can see how they're doing and improve in a real-time basis. And finally, and I'll go into this in a little more detail in a few minutes, strengthening the logic model by really assessing the dose of the intervention. How strong was the intervention, and how likely was it, therefore, to have an effect? As mentioned by some of my colleagues, there are emerging domains for data collection where we really don't have a lot of information at the local, state, or national level around changes in the environment. These can be collected locally through surveys of perceptions of environments, through actually going out and observing unobtrusively environments, such as how many people are using parks or what people are buying in stores, or using secondary data that's available from planning departments, for example, through GIS methodologies. Policy change data, as Jamie mentioned, is also hard to come by. You can get this locally opportunistically by talking to key informants and finding out just generally what's up. Or you can set up systematic surveillance systems which systematically, on a periodic basis, review government sources, review websites, and review the media to try to have a sense of what kind of policy has been adopted or implemented. And finally, systems change data is even harder to find if you define systems change as changing the relationships between sectors and institutions and agencies as how they do business to produce a more robust, say, food system. That is not generally not there, and using social networking methodology or other methods to map these changing relationships can be useful. It's important to think through the goals of evaluation and what you're trying to do, and the committee identified three general purposes of evaluation. When we often think of evaluation, we think of causal attribution. Doing X produces Y. So our local obesity prevention initiative reduced childhood obesity by 10%. However, oftentimes that's not the goal and it's not necessary. Showing an association can be sufficient for policy development work or for local work, showing that the rate fell 10% after the initiative was implemented, but not necessarily be able to rigorously ascribe causality. And even in some cases, just demonstrating progress that the obesity prevention completed tasks A, B, and C can be of enormous value. So therefore, it's important, the committee felt, to match the goal of the evaluation design to the goal of what you want to evaluate. And there's a spectrum of types of designs that the report goes through, and I won't go through all the detail, but just to point out that most evaluations that we found were pre-post, and pre-post evaluations alone can never define causality. They can be strengthened if you add a non-equivalent comparison group or some kind of control group. But still, they're a relatively weak design for causality, but they're very useful for monitoring progress, for example. Multiple baselines help out by controlling somewhat for temporal trends that might be there. And then I'll go back to the middle quality, this logic model and causal model. But there are other methods as well, which I will talk about in less detail later. One general point also is all these quantitative metrics models, rather, can be supplemented by qualitative methods, and mixed methods are both powerful and emerging in popularity here. So let me spend the next couple of minutes and then start to wrap up around how we can do this in a cost-effective way around logic model designs. A logic model design says that in the basis of the evidence and the literature, if you do intervention A, you should be able to see change X in a behavior or in obesity. And so if you measure over time the cumulative number of community changes that relate to doing X, and you see a corresponding temporal trend in the outcome Y, then you can have some confidence that what you're doing is making a difference. So in this case, mapping community changes might be around physical activity changes or food and nutrition changes, and looking at the changes in obesity rates in this method. To do this method even with more sophistication introduces the notion of population dose. Dose is how much intervention happened in your community, and this has to do with both the effect size of the intervention and how many people you reached, or penetration of the intervention. For example, if you put a walking trail in, and you know from either previous literature or your own evaluation that being within half a mile of a walking trail increases the number of minutes a day of physical activity by 10%, and 20% of your population lives near the walking trail, then the dose would be 10% times 20%, or on the average, you'd expect to see a 2% increase in the daily minutes across the entire population. If you then sum all these doses across multiple interventions, say directed at physical activity, to come up with a cumulative population dose, and then you see physical activity actually changes, but something with a smaller dose, say eating fruits and vegetables, did not change because you had a lower dose intervention there, you can with more confidence conclude that your intervention did indeed have an effect. A final model that's just beginning to be applied, which approaches a randomized controlled trial, is what's called a regression discontinuity model, where you divide your community into intervention situation or context and non-intervention. So for example, pick schools that have a higher rate of BMI versus those that have a lower rate of elevated BMI, and then intervene in your high BMI schools. What you would see if you plot the pretest school BMI versus the post-intervention BMI, you would see a discontinuity in the slope of that association between pre and post BMIs, indicating that there is an intervention effect. And so this lets you, in effect, create two intervention groups without doing a randomized controlled trial. So I'll end here by saying, well, you know, we don't have a lot of resources at the local level, so how do we do all this? The committee has some recommendations. Examples of this include focusing on only selected components of multi-site or multi-component interventions, conducting the shorter-term interventions on outputs and outcomes, use existing data, including community health assessment data in your community, use qualitative methods, and use proxy populations. For example, instead of all school-age kids, pick certain grades. There's a table at the end, table 8.3, which shows how you could do a low cost, moderate cost, and high cost evaluation and what some of the components of that might be. So I'd refer you to look at that table to sort of see how there might be different models that may be appropriate. So in conclusion, what the committee found in terms of looking at the community level is that the data are generally not available. This is especially true for younger children, for determinants of obesity, and I might add for populations affected by health inequity. And you might want to look at what data are available from other sectors, such as healthcare, your planning department, and so on. But we definitely need improved surveillance systems, greater sample sizes, data for these missing indicators, and so on to do a robust evaluation. So I'll conclude here and turn it over to have the rest of our colleagues join us. Right, Larry?
Yes, please.
Yeah,
you can hold that seat up.